crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nachtigall. We're finally back here in Jerusalem for today's program. Thank you very much to Christopher Eames, who took last week's show. If you haven't listened to that, I'd go back and find that. I can leave a link for that under today's show notes if you don't know where to find it. And that is all about the prophet Jeremiah, and he goes in depth to show just how much the life and the times of that prophet are clearly visible in the archaeological discoveries, both in Jerusalem and throughout Israel. Please go back and read that. He's put a lot of effort into it, and even the accompanying article has a lot of pictures and graphics and also some little videos that would help you understand just how much has been discovered so far relating to that biblical prophet. Well, after a couple of weeks in the United States, as I said, I'm back here in Jerusalem, and I only had a few hours before arriving, after I arrived in Jerusalem, before a bunch of students from our Edstone campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College came to visit me, and visit Israel, really, and I'm here as their tour guide. For the last few days, we've been touring about Israel, giving them a good feel for just the geographic diversity that exists here in Israel. It's quite amazing. Having traveled about this country over the past decade, I'm always amazed at how you can drive half an hour or even 20 minutes and you have a different geographic setting. And it kind of, the state of Israel in one way reminds me of just a shrunken version of the state of California. You have beaches, you have mountains, you have snow, you have deserts, you have forested areas as well. Really, Israel has it all. And that's kind of what I was trying to show some of the students as they visited. Of course, we saw actual biblical sites as well, archaeological sites throughout Israel. We were able to go to the north for a couple of days. We visited Capernaum on the northern slope or northern sea or northern shore of the Sea of Galilee or the Kinneret. And then we drove up to the Golan Heights. We visited Mount Bental. That's not necessarily an archaeological site at all, but it is up nice and high and right on the border of Syria, really just giving the students a pretty good sense of, again, the precarious situation that Israel, the current state of Israel, exists in. And then after that, we just dropped off the Golan Heights and visited Banyas. That's a beautiful spring. And the ancient city of Caesarea Philippi from 2,000 years ago is constructed there. This, of course, was the capital of this province or this area of Golanitis. And the main leader that built this capital was Herod Agrippa II. And he came into power there after his father died in 44 CE. He ruled from there all the way until 70 AD when the Jews were removed. And nevertheless, we saw that beautiful palace, and then we drove a little bit further down the road to Tel Dan. This is a very important biblical site. This is where the Tel Dan Stele was found back in the 90s, which discusses the House of David. This is also the location of where King Jeroboam, after Solomon, well, after Rehoboam, really broke off from the house of David, and Israel split into two and took the northern 10 tribes with him. He decided to set up this place of Dan as a center of worship, and you can go there and see this very impressive worship area, this temple area. It's not necessarily a temple there, but there is a large altar, at least the foundations of that, and a bama or a high place where that golden calf might have stood back 2,800, 2,900 years ago. Following Dan, we went to En Harod, which is a kibbutz right next to, or very close to, that spring or the En that that is famous from the biblical story of Gideon, the judge Gideon, that's where the 300 men were chosen to fight against, I think it was the Midianites, I believe, might have that wrong off the top of my head, but they, those 300 were right there below Mount Gilboa. That's another place that has biblical significance because that's where King Saul was killed. And then across the valley, the hills of Moreh, where the opposing army was waiting for this fight against the Israelites during the period of the judges. Anyhow, it's just been a fantastic trip just for a few days. And it is wonderful to be able to just drive through and stop every half an hour and talk about the biblical events that took place in these locations. And it is absolutely dramatic to see how well the Bible and the biblical narrative stacks up to the historical or the geographic reality of Israel. The people that comment on whether the Bible is accurate or not, they can't help but notice that the stories themselves, while they might not believe in all the characters necessarily, they will agree that they fit perfectly into the geography of the region. If somebody was making it up, they were very good at their job. They researched the area. They knew where the hills were, where the creeks were, and it all very much checks out. Now, just after we visited En Harod, we actually stayed there at the kibbutz for a night. We traveled towards Caesarea, and just from En Harod in this large valley that will go all the way up to Haifa on the coast, we traveled past Jezreel. And this, while I was driving past there, I was discussing that this was the place that Elijah, after summoning or praying to God on Mount Carmel, off close to Haifa, I forget how long far away it is, probably 20 plus miles. He had the thunderstorm came. You'll remember after the rain started to come after we prayed seven times, and then he raced down the hill and all the way he raced to Jezreel, one of these big cities in the northern tribes, and he actually outran the king Ahab, who was riding his chariot. And while I was talking about that, I wasn't really thinking about this other story that took place in Jezreel. Yet as I got back to Jerusalem this week and checked some of the archaeological news, what I found was a story that was published in the Torah, which relates very much to Jezreel. And I want to discuss that on today's program. Jezreel, of course, is this location where a lot of the dealings of the Omri dynasty or Omri and Ahab took place. And the famous woman in this story around this period is Jezebel. And as related to at least Jezreel, the story that I want to cover today is about Naboth. Now, if you recall your biblical history about this time, this is just after around this time of Elijah, he features in this story, of course, as well. And you had neighboring the property of Ahab right here in Jezreel. You had Naboth, and Naboth had a vineyard, and Ahab coveted that vineyard. Of course, he went up to Naboth and asked, "Hey, can I have your vineyard? I'll pay you, and I'll give you some appropriate land elsewhere. And everything will be great. Would you like to do this deal?" And this is what 1 Kings 21 verse 1 says. It says, "And it came to pass after these things," and this is a couple of chapters after this incident of Ahab and Elijah on Mount Carmel. "And it came to pass after these things that Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard which was in Jezreel, hard by the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria." Samaria, of course, is a little bit further to the south from Jezreel. "And Ahab spoke unto Naboth, saying, 'Give me your vineyard that I may have it for a garden of herbs, because it is near unto my house, and I will give you for a better vineyard than it. Or if it seems good to you, I will give you the worth of it in money.'" Seems like a fair deal. Verse 3, "And Naboth said to Ahab, 'The Lord forbid me that I should give the inheritance of my fathers unto you.' And Ahab, at hearing that, came into his house sullen and displeased, because the word of Naboth the Jezreelite had spoken to him, for he had said, 'I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers.' And he laid him down upon his bed, and he turned his face away and would not eat bread." So he's quite upset about this. Naboth, of course, is doing the right thing. This was inherited land that belonged to his fathers. He wasn't going to give it away. Of course, wicked Jezebel sees what's going on, sees her husband there, destitute, upset over this because he can't take this land. And then she says unto him, "Why is your spirit so sullen that you eat no bread?" And he said unto her, this is verse 6 now, "Because I spoke unto Naboth the Jezreelite and said unto him, give me your vineyard for money, or else, if it please you, I will give you another vineyard for it. And he answered, I will not give you my vineyard. And then Jezebel his wife said unto him, like a good supporting wife, do you now govern the kingdom of Israel? Arise and eat bread, and let your heart be merry. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite." So this story, you can go back again and read this in 1 Kings chapter 21. It then goes on to talk about how Jezebel is going to organize the situation where she's going to convict Naboth through false witnesses. And he would end up actually being stoned. And other scriptures bring out that even his sons were stoned. So all the heirs of this land were taken out of the way as well. And then, of course, Ahab got that land, or at least, you know, it didn't work out the very best for him, of course, as you know, the rest of the story with Elijah coming to him, that this would eventually end up in his death or core, one of the reasons that he would die. But what I want to talk about is not necessarily the most of that biblical story, but I just wanted to give you some context. But this article that was written detailing this vineyard that is in Jezreel, that the Bible says should be in Jezreel. And here is this article. I'll leave it in the notes again that you can read. It's called The Story of Naboth's Vineyard and the Ancient Winery in Jezreel. And then the quip is, what light can archaeology shed on the significance and location of the vineyard? And this was written by Dr. Norma Franklin. She's the excavator at Jezreel, and she's also from the University of Haifa. And then she basically starts out discussing this situation that I've just mentioned. But then she talks about the key part of this story is a vineyard. And she asks, what light can archaeology shed on this vineyard and its place in Jezreel? Now, this area of Jezreel, of course, it's built right on the outcropping or the rocky spur of the foothills of Mount Gilboa. It's overlooking the fertile Jezreel Valley. Jezreel Valley, of course, is named after this place, Jezreel. And it's really provides, even to this day, ideal conditions for agriculture and grazing. Now, vineyards themselves, they're not going to leave many archaeological remains. Why? Because, of course, it's organic material. It's going to rot, especially after 2,800 years. But maybe it's possible that a winery would exist. Now, it makes sense during the biblical period, and even today, that the winery is generally located right next to the vineyard. Saves on travel costs and transportation costs. And this is how it was anciently as well. She goes on to write, this is Norma Franklin, in Area K, one of the areas here of Jezreel, a particularly impressive installation was carved into the limestone bedrock at the foot of the hill of Jezreel, northeast of the area excavated in the 1990s and directly south of a large fertile terrace that sloped towards the spring of Jezreel. And then it talks about this complex, or this winery, really, as she'll go on to say, covers an area of approximately 12 square meters, and its characteristics indicate that it was a winery. And she lists some of these characteristics. There's a square rock-cut treading floor measuring 3.2 meters on each side. So this is where they would have stamped on the grapes. 3.2 meters on each side, this treading floor that's carved into bedrock. There were two adjacent rock-cut vats, each holding about 1.3 meters squared and over 1 meter. Well, they're 1.3 meters square, and they each were over 1 meter deep. Next, she says that the treading floor, which slopes down towards a vat, she's calling vat one, is connected to it by a 15 centimeter long, 5 centimeter wide rock-cut channel. Of course, this was where the wine would flow. Then she says a sump for collecting liquids in the northwest corner of that one. There was another vat, she's calling vat two, located to the east of the treading floor, but not connected to it. And then she says there's also a deep circular basin northeast of the treading floor, 1 meter in diameter, that could possibly function as another vat. So what we have here, a treading floor, and then we have a type of hollowed out rock cut channel where the wine would have flowed. And then you have an area that would have collected the liquids, or some of the liquids. And then you have three separate vats right here in Jezreel, right where the Bible says should be a vineyard. Then she goes on to discuss how this wine here was obviously made in the traditional way of grape stomping, and how that would preserve, in many ways, the flavor of the wine better than a wine press, because the wine press does crush the pips, the little grape seeds, and that does change the taste of the wine. Sometimes that can be desirable, but in this case, treading the grapes by foot isn't going to change that flavor of the wine in that way. Anyhow, I just think it's absolutely amazing that she discusses this, and that they've found this winery right there in Jezreel, where this vineyard was meant to have been back during the time of Ahab, just as the Bible describes. Now, I don't really want to read all of this, and you can look at this article online, and it has pictures in it as well of this ancient installation that is most likely a winery. But this is what she says towards the end. The Bible names the owner of the vineyard as Naboth the Jezreelite. The use of this gentilic implies that he resided somewhere else as well. So it's saying the qualifier there, Jezreelite, indicates he might have lived somewhere else as well. And this would indicate also that he's quite wealthy because he has a vineyard. So that kind of fits the bill. Then she writes, whether or not the Naboth, the Jezreelite, is a historical character, whoever owned that plot of land and its vineyard was certainly well off and not a simple poor farmer. So she's saying that we don't know if Naboth, the Jezreelite, was a historical character, but the biblical description of him fits. The fact that he has a vineyard here and is possibly located elsewhere. Then she continues to write, we cannot know if any part of the account of Naboth's vineyard is historical, but its author knew at least that ancient Jezreel had a vineyard and a winery, and this area was near the large installation that probably served to house the king, among others, when he was in Jezreel. Moreover, the editor of Kings is clearly picturing a vineyard located east of Jezreel and close to the main highway, the Via Maris. The location of the winery east of Jezreel, east of the Jezreel enclosure, and near the junction of the Via Maris with the ridge route to Jezreel and onto Samaria correlates well with the story. Sorry, there's a lot to read there, but it's just very interesting because you have this archaeologist who is a very good archaeologist, and yet she says, she dances around this completely, saying we don't know if Naboth the Jezreelite is a historical character, and we don't know if any of this account is actually real, but every detail it mentions, apart from the actual narrative, the fact that there's a vineyard, the fact that there's a winery, the fact that it's close to the Via Maris, or the main trade route north, and the main across this land, and also the main north-south trade route, fits out perfectly with the Bible. So the way that she would discuss this is, well, this isn't necessarily proof that this event took place, but rather it shows that whoever was writing it was extremely well versed in the geography of the region. I just find that laughable to an extent. Why? Why can't she just come out and say, well, it doesn't say, we haven't found this was Naboth the Jezreelite's or Naboth inscribed in the stone of this winery, in this installation, in bedrock. We haven't found that. But everything else looks extremely like the biblical story, and there's no reason to doubt that the biblical story is correct. Why not just say that? Some archaeologists would. Not many, but some would come out and be bold enough to say that. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to discuss an archaeological discovery that wasn't necessarily made in Israel, yet it has everything to do with one site in Israel, that of Caesarea. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This is Watch Jerusalem on KPCG.fm.
They call it the City of Peace. But it is filled with violence. Yesterday, bloody crusades and sieges. Today, terrorism, rocket attacks, and stabbings. Intense international pressure, but no diplomatic solutions. This is Jerusalem. No city has suffered like it. Will there ever be peace? God says yes. There will be peace in Jerusalem, and not just for the Jews. It will be a peace that spreads to all people. How will God bring peace to Jerusalem? Request your free copy of Jerusalem in Prophecy to find out. The answer comes straight from your Bible. Peace is coming soon. Act today.
Please visit thetrumpet.com. This is Watch Jerusalem. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. We were just talking about Jezreel and the vineyard that was found, or the winery that was found there, and the whole geographic setting and how it relates perfectly to the story of Naboth. We're going to move a little bit further to the west now, and this is where we traveled again on our trip just a couple of days ago through Israel. We went on to Caesarea from Jezreel, and there in Caesarea you see this massive city, beautiful Roman city, still with so many remains there visible to any tourist that visits from this Roman period. A city, of course, built by King Herod. Herod, of course, ruled Judea as king from 37 to 4 BCE. And then after he died, shortly thereafter, after his son Archelaus actually was removed from ruling in Judea, this city became the chief city in Judea where the Roman procurators or prefects ruled from. After Archelaus, Herod the Great's son, was removed, Judea became a Roman imperial province, the Romans deeming this area too important to allow a foreigner to rule, and so they had one of their financial agents, or basically a governor, that he would rule from this town of Caesarea and then come to Jerusalem every now and then, especially over the holy days or the festivals, to ensure that the Jews didn't get too feisty or too riled up and didn't want to rebel against the Roman Empire, to keep an eye on things. But most of the time throughout the year, he would be located in this beautiful city of Caesarea, replete with beautiful bathhouse, beautiful hippodrome where they would have seen chariot races and gladiatorial games, a massive theater as well. That's all still there from 2,000 years ago, and you can go see that. But one of the great parts of this city is the construction by King Herod of the port. The port itself, it's a really an ancient marvel, just the way that this was designed. And there is set up there in Caesarea an underwater diving center, and you can have tours of that. I haven't yet. I don't have my dive license, but it's something that I would like to do. I'd like to do at some point. And what they've uncovered here is this port that really engineers today would have been, if they really studied the way that this works, would be really surprised at how the ancient 2,000-year-old king found solutions to many of the perennial problems of the profession. And I'm just going to go through a couple of these and then discuss what was recent, the discovery of this past week, and how it relates to Caesarea and what King Herod did. This article, this comes from the old Caesarea Diving Center. Again, I'll leave a link for this for you to read up about, and you can check the pictures as well if some of this is a little bit unclear. But it does definitely show, just studying this port from 2,000 years ago, how much the ancients understood. We tend to think of ancient people as being perhaps a little bit less intelligent than us, or maybe not capable of equal architectural engineering feats. Sure, they didn't have the technologies yet. that we have today. But wow, did they understand how to solve problems? How to solve problems. And King Herod, though he was quite mad throughout his life, he did pour a lot of time, resources, and his own intellect into creating some magnificent buildings all over Israel. And this one of Caesarea, and specifically this port, is no exception. One of the features that this article discusses here was this amazing, sophisticated method that was used to build the port. Now, most of the foundations of this port were made by concrete. This, of course, was a Roman invention around this same period. Some credit to Herod himself. But this concrete, even though it's so common to us today, has only been around in modern times for 300 years or so. And it was really forgotten from Roman times all the way up till the Renaissance. And so they were quite ahead, the Romans were, at using this concrete and no less concrete that is used in water. And I want to talk about this concrete because how they constructed these massive breakwaters, one of the ways that they built these was by pouring concrete into wooden cases of varying sizes, and they would be prefabricated on the shore by master carpenters from the best imported timber. And the remains of some of these cases are preserved in some areas actually still to this day. Anyhow, the concrete itself was made of limestone, cobbles, lime, and an essential quantity of an imported volcanic ash. It was made of volcanic ash. That's how the Romans had their concrete. Built their concrete. Now today, there's something that's a little bit different. We don't use this volcanic ash. Of course, it's probably a little bit more scarce than what we use today to create our concrete. Yet what they've discovered this week was that the use of volcanic ash inside this mixture for concrete actually ensures that this the concrete underwater does not corrode and actually becomes stronger with time. Stronger with time. This article is from the BBC, and it's written by Matt McGrath from the 4th of July. He says, scientists explain ancient Rome's long-lasting concrete. Now, he doesn't talk about Caesarea in this article, but this same concrete exists in Caesarea, in this massive harbor built by King Herod. This is what he writes, and again, I'll leave this article for you to read. In the show notes below, he says, ancient sea walls built by the Romans used a concrete made from lime and volcanic ash to bind with the rocks. Now, scientists have discovered that elements within the volcanic material reacted with the seawater to strengthen the construction. It actually strengthens the construction. Unlike the modern concrete mixture, which erodes over time, the Roman substance has long puzzled researchers. Rather than eroding, particularly in the presence of seawater, the material seems to gain strength from the exposure. So it actually becomes stronger and stronger and stronger over time. And this is incredible. And this is what was used in this port at Caesarea by King Herod. Now, the lead author of this study that looks at these compounds inside the volcanic material that makes up this concrete, and her name is Marie Jackson, she says this from the University of Utah, contrary to the principles of modern cement-based concrete, the Romans created a rock-like concrete that thrives in open chemical exchange with seawater. Now, modern buildings, they're constructed with concrete based on Portland cement. This involves heating and crushing a mixture of several ingredients, including limestone, sandstone, ash, chalk, iron, and clay. The fine material then, of course, is mixed with different aggregates, rock, sand, different rock and sand to build the concrete structures that we see today. Now, of course, we would be nice to start using these volcanic rocks in our concrete because they even say that it could be more environmentally friendly. It actually produces a lot less CO2 with its construction, but it might be difficult because it's hard to find so much of it. There's not much around. But then it says the Romans, the scientists say, were fortunate that the right materials were right on their doorstep. That's true. That's true because they were looking at different Roman examples of this, but they didn't really look all the way over in Caesarea, or at least they didn't mention it. And they say, whoa, it'd be difficult to send this around. They had it right on their doorstep. Well, if you look over into the far eastern part of the Mediterranean Sea, all the way to Israel, you have King Herod. King Herod using this material, using this volcanic rock in his version of concrete. And 2,000 years later, you can go diving here at Caesarea, and you can see these huge concrete blocks that in some ways have become stronger over the past 2,000 years. And that's just one example of the genius of King Herod 2,000 years ago in the construction of this town or city of Caesarea. Well, after seeing Caesarea, we made our way back to Jerusalem, where we've completed our trip, where we toured a number of sites here, the city of David, the Ophel excavations. We went through Hezekiah's tunnel, as did thousands and thousands of people, it seems, on Friday. Again, if you would like to have a tour, especially of the Ophel and city of David, the Palace of David excavations, I would be very happy to take about 3 hours out of your day and give you a personal tour of that. So there are some people that are taking me up on that offer, and I'm very pleased about that. But if you are in Jerusalem anytime soon, you can respond to the show. You can send your emails to letters@watchjerusalem.co.il, request a tour, or just give us some feedback on the show and maybe even potentially things that you would like to see us discuss. Thanks very much for listening today. You've been listening to Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive.